Eye News. I'm Laurel Bowman. U.S. President Joe Biden on the campaign trail today will make some big announcements, the AP's Sagar Magani reports.
President Biden wants a sharp boost in tariffs on Chinese steel as he courts union voters in Pittsburgh. At the United Steelworkers headquarters today, the president will call for tripling levies on Chinese steel and aluminum. The White House insists the move is more about shielding American manufacturing from cheap imports than it is about firing up a union audience. Senior administration officials say China produces about half the world's steel and sells it on the world market for less than half what U.S.-produced steel costs. But higher tariffs can pose their own economic risks by potentially making steel and aluminum more expensive, and thus making things like cars and other key goods cost more for American consumers. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A top envoy says the U.S. is determined to monitor North Korean nukes, the AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
In Seoul, top envoy Linda Thomas-Greenfield has told a press briefing the U.S. will work inside and outside the U.N. to keep North Korea from illegal activities.
The point here is that we cannot allow the work that the panel of experts were doing to lapse. We have to continue to keep eyes on and reporting on the illegal activities of the DPRK and efforts to break the sanctions that have been put in place.
The ambassador added she does not expect Russia and China to change their stance and cooperate with other members of the UN Security Council to hold Pyongyang accountable for their efforts to break sanctions. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And European Union leaders meet Wednesday to discuss more sanctions against Iran after its attack on Israel. This is VOA News. Israel is still considering how to respond to Iran's weekend missile and drone strikes as the United States and its allies urge the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu not to escalate and risk igniting a wider regional conflict. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wittikuswada has this report.
Netanyahu faces domestic pressure and international condemnation over the war in Gaza. Some are accusing him of intentional escalation with Iran, including Ayman Savadi, the foreign minister of Jordan, a U.S. ally that helped to protect Israel from Tehran's attacks. Ayman Safadi said it's no secret that Netanyahu's policy aims to expand the conflict to relieve the growing pressure on him globally because of the killing, war, and destruction he is doing in Gaza. Other leaders have echoed calls for restraint. It's unclear whether Netanyahu will heed them. Patsy Wittikuswada, VOA News, Washington.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has ordered the closure of his country's embassy and consulates in Ecuador in solidarity with Mexico in its protest over a raid by Ecuadorian authorities on the Mexican embassy in Quito. Details from VOA's Tommy McNeil.
Maduro says Venezuela also fully supports Mexico's request to have the United Nations suspend Ecuador from the world body. Maduro spoke during a virtual meeting of the leaders of the community of Latin American and Caribbean states. Ecuadorian President Daniel Noboa ordered authorities to raid the Mexican diplomatic outpost April 5th to arrest the country's former vice president, Jorge Glass, a convicted criminal and fugitive who was holed up at the embassy since December. Mexico granted him asylum hours before the raid. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
The Kremlin said Wednesday that Russian peacekeepers had begun withdrawing from Azerbaijan's Karabakh area, ending a multi-year deployment which gave Moscow an important foothold in the strategically important region. Azerbaijan retook the breakaway region of Nagorno-Karabakh in September of last year, despite the presence there of Russian peacekeepers. This move triggered the mass exodus of ethnic Armenians living there. Georgia's parliament on Wednesday approved the first reading of a bill on foreign agents that has provoked several days of protests by critics who see it as an authoritarian and Russian-inspired bill. That's what Georgian media is reporting. For more stories, please visit us online at voanews.com. I'm Laurel Bowman for VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
What we're seeing here is a level of risk acceptance on behalf of the Iranians, which I think has the potential to plunge the entire region into a war. And if we take the Iranians at their word, inadvertently, that's very, very, very dangerous. So I am concerned.
That's David DeRoche, associate professor at the National Defense University, on concerns Iran's attack on Israel could lead to escalation. Details coming up. Also, 75% of the 1,000 doctors trained in Cameroon flee to developing countries for a better life. And a UNHCR chief, Volker Turk, visits the DRC. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Here's our top story. A year since war broke out in Sudan, analysts foresee no end to the conflict and say the longer it drags on, the more likely Sudan will become a breeding ground for terrorist groups. VOA spoke via video to a volunteer at one of the last functioning hospitals in Omdurman. Henry Wilkins reports.
From day one of Sudan's war a year ago, fighting between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces has ravaged Sudan's twin cities of Khartoum, its capital, and Omdurman, its largest. Millions have fled the metropolitan area because of the fighting. Some have stayed, however, either because they don't have the means to leave, or in a few cases, because they chose to stay and help. Momin Ahmed Abbas volunteers at one of Omdurman's last functional hospitals and refuses to flee the city. Speaking to VOA via video call, Abbas says he cannot abandon his patients, especially when they rely on his support. He stays to ensure they have access to essentials like food, shelter, and medical care. His leaving, he says, would only exacerbate the situation for those in need. He says the situation is desperate at the hospital, which lacks medical supplies and security, and is vulnerable to frequent airstrikes and fighting. Humanitarian groups and international journalists have found entry into Khartoum and many other parts of Sudan all but impossible. And as a result, the world's awareness of the country's troubles has diminished. Commentators and diplomats often refer to Sudan's conflict as the world's forgotten war, despite as many as 16,000 people estimated to have died because of the conflict and 8.6 million forcibly displaced. Analysts say pressure from the international community is needed to bring the warring sides to the negotiating table. But one doesn't see that happening anytime soon. Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow in the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Sadly, I don't see this conflict as particularly ripe for any kind of resolution right now. Both sides think either that they can win or they have to win. And as long as they continue to be sustained by external actors, providing them weapons and intelligence, then they're going to continue this fight.
A recent U.S. intelligence report says the longer the war drags on, the more likely Sudan will become a breeding ground for terrorists. One analyst who spoke to VOA echoed this view. Bakary El-Medni is a Sudanese-born associate professor at Long Island University, who has written for numerous publications and been frequently quoted on Sudanese politics.
You got young people, and they have all the fuel. They have the anger, they have the ethnic division, and then they have whatever is the narrative about there is a just war happening somewhere.
Leaders of both warring sides are wildly unpopular among most Sudanese. Neither has ever been democratically elected. Yet Sudanese civilians are the ones bearing the brunt of the ongoing fighting. Abbas says Sudan needs external help and intervention. Yet, after 1 year of fighting in Sudan, it seems clear that no substantial help is on its way. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
With Iran's first direct attack on Israel, the two sworn enemies have entered a far more dangerous phase in their long-standing confrontation. Some experts believe that the Middle East is now a uniquely dangerous moment with the potential for escalation into an all-out war that would endanger millions of civilians. President Biden has already warned Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the United States will not join Israel in retaliation. David DeRoche, associate professor at the National Defense University, discussed this with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
I think that we are in a dangerous moment. One of the things that really concerns me is that it appears that Iran is rather cavalier in its use of force. So having launched an unprecedented attack against Israel, not just unprecedented in terms of attack against Israel, but unprecedented in terms of the scale and the types of weapons used, it's unprecedented in the region. Iran then goes and says, well, our attack was defeated, but we meant that to happen. We just wanted to send a message. Well, you know, if you send 330 armed projectiles at a country, you're running a risk that one of them may go off course, may malfunction, and cause some serious damage. And that damage will not be interpreted as an honest mistake by the person who is damaged. So what we're seeing here is a level of risk acceptance on behalf of the Iranians, which I think has the potential to plunge the entire region into a war. And if we take the Iranians at their word, inadvertently, that's very, very, very dangerous. So I am concerned.
President Biden has already warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the United States will not join Israel in any retaliation. Nevertheless, Israel announced that there will be an Israeli response to the unsuccessful Iranian attack. Would that lead to an eventual escalation into a regional war?
Well, the Iranians will want to portray it that way in order to prevent this response. But I don't think that Netanyahu can survive as a politician if they just say, well, you fired 330 things at us, we shot them down, so we're done. I think there has to be some sort of response, and it has to be significant in order to ensure that this sort of behavior doesn't become normal. What Israel has to consider are a couple factors. The first factor is their capacity and their abilities. And I don't think Israel, for example, has the ability to take out all of Iran's nuclear infrastructure by themselves. They also have to be careful that they don't inadvertently reinforce the Revolutionary Guard regime, which basically had a sort of slow motion coup of the Iranian government starting with the Green Revolution in 2009. You know, a direct Israeli attack that is disproportionate will serve the purpose of discrediting the Iranian opposition, which continues to protest throughout the country. So what they need to do is find a target that's closely linked with the Revolutionary Guard or with the military capacity like missile factories or drone factories, and perhaps respond against those. The ideal target would be an economic activity that's owned by a prominent Revolutionary Guard member that is inefficient, that everybody knows is part of the 45% of the Iranian economy controlled by the Revolutionary Guard. If they could destroy that facility, that would have the effect of both targeting the Revolutionary Guard directly, as well as exacerbating the growing inequities that we're seeing under what is becoming a theocratic military regime in Iran.
But some experts say that if it does strike back, Israel risks triggering an endless tit-for-tat with Iran up to the escalatory ladder toward a general Middle East conflagration. Do you agree with this analysis?
No, I don't agree with the premise. I don't think Israel wants to escalate. I think that they do feel that they have to restore deterrence, that they have to strike a strong blow against Iran so that they will not consider this sort of action again, because Israel doesn't have the capacity and Israel's partners don't have the capacity to repel five of these attacks in 1 week. So they do have to respond. The challenge is when you respond to something, if you're seeking to establish deterrence, then the other side may not see it that way. They may see it as something that needs to be acted to. So in the statement that the Iranian embassy to the UN put out, they said, okay, we're doing this to restore deterrence for the killing of seven Revolutionary Guard officers at the consulate in Damascus, and we consider the matter to be finished. But I don't think Israel can accept that logic. I think that there will be some sort of strike, but I think that the Biden administration is trying to limit it, that it will be much more directed and proportionate. And I think that Iran will probably have to take it. There are no shortage of targets, but we'll see what that is.
That was David DeRoche, associate professor at the National Defense University, talking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy. Since war broke out between Israel and Hamas in October, Egypt has kept the Rafah border crossing from Gaza closed to most Palestinians. But one company is offering travel from Gaza into Egypt for thousands of dollars per person, prompting accusations that it is profiteering from refugees. Henry Ridgewell tells us the story.
From her home in Cairo, Etemad Abu Tahoun watches with terror as, hour by hour, the television news relays the devastation wrought on Gaza. Her only son, 23-year-old Momen, is trapped in the Palestinian territory. A brief, broken video call confirms he is still alive before the signal cuts off. Etemad, who is battling health problems, is trying to crowdfund enough money to pay for her son's escape. She told VOA that she will help her son to escape the killing in Gaza and that his presence will be her support as she navigates the challenges that lie ahead. Escaping Gaza isn't easy. Egypt has closed the Rafah crossing to most Palestinians, fearing an exodus of refugees. But money talks. Since the Israel-Hamas war broke out in October, Egypt has permitted just a single travel agency called Hala to operate cross-border journeys from Gaza into Egypt, what it terms a coordination. The firm is based in the office of its parent company, Organi, in Cairo. Its fees have reportedly risen 14-fold from the pre-war price to $5,000 per adult and half that for children. That's far beyond the means of most Palestinians, especially those who have lost their homes and livelihoods in the war. Many have sought financial help from friends and family or launched internet crowdfunding campaigns with desperate pleas for help. Mohammed Raed, a Palestinian medical student based in Cairo, is crowdfunding to pay for six displaced family members to escape a refugee camp in Gaza.
I'm nothing without my family. So if I want to continue my study here and succeed in my life, I want to see it in my family faces and eyes. So if they're not here for me, so all my efforts, all the things I do went in vain.
Hala did not respond to VOA requests for comment. The agency now accounts for 40% of all crossings from Gaza into Egypt, according to the Cairo-based Arab Organization for Human Rights. It says accusations of profiteering are an attempt to divert attention from Israel's actions and praises Egypt's effort to send aid into Gaza. Alaa Shalabi, the head of the organization, said they commend the admirable efforts of Egypt and its communities who are grappling with their own economic difficulties in providing significant support to Gaza. Despite protests in Cairo calling for a change of policy, the Egyptian government says it has no plans to open the Rafah crossing with Gaza. With little food or shelter, let alone money, most Palestinians are trapped with no means of escape from this brutal war. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Abdoulaye Batali, the United Nations envoy to Libya, has tendered his resignation, saying his mediation efforts have been met with stubborn resistance, unreasonable expectations, and indifference to the interests of the Libyan people. He told the UN Security Council yesterday that since the end of 2022, the United Nations-led efforts to help resolve Libya's political crisis through elections faced national as well as regional pushbacks, revealing an intentional defiance to engage in earnest and a tenacity to perpetually delay elections. Reuters reports that Battali said the renewed scramble for Libya, its position, and immense resources among internal and external players is rendering a solution ever elusive. He was appointed as UN envoy in September 2022. It was not immediately clear when Battali plans to step down. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk is today beginning an official visit to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, at the invitation of the government. The High Commissioner is due to meet President Felix Tshisekedi and senior members of the government. Also in Kinshasa, he will meet civil society representatives, the National Human Rights Commission, members of political parties, and the diplomatic community. He will hold talks with the special representative of the Secretary General, Bintou Keita, other senior MONUSCO officials, and the UN country team. Turk, according to a UN press release, will also travel to eastern DRC, where he will visit camps for internally displaced people and have a series of meetings with human rights defenders and civil society organizations. The Cameroon Medical Council, an association of doctors, says the state of health care is a source of growing concern in the country, where there is only one doctor for every 50,000 patients instead of the World Health Organization's recommended ratio of one doctor per 10,000 patients. Officials say 75% of the 1,000 doctors that Cameroon's government trains each year are fleeing to developed countries to escape hardship, poor pay, and difficult working conditions. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
Officials in Cameroon say thousands of doctors are fleeing the Central African country for lucrative jobs in developed countries, especially in Europe and North America. Cameroon's Minister of Public Health reports that several hundred doctors are enrolled in what members of the profession see as lucrative schemes to emigrate to Canada. Officials say that the number of people acquiring passports and applying for visas to leave the country, especially health workers, including doctors, has increased by 70%. The number of health workers, including doctors applying for the U.S. government's Diversity Immigration Visa Program, also known as Green Card Lottery, is on the increase. The Cameroon Medical Council reports that the doctors are fleeing hardship, poor pay, difficult working conditions, and unemployment. Dr. Peter Louis Ndifor, the council's vice president, says it is unfortunate that Cameroon trains but does not recruit thousands of its doctors. He spoke to VOA via telephone from Boya, an English-speaking town in southwestern Cameroon.
We have 5,000 to 6,000 doctors in Cameroon presently. Doctors quitting Cameroon is an eloquent testimony that doctors are in discomfort. Doctors are in distress.
Ndifor said the doctor-patient ratio in Cameroon has sunk to one doctor per 50,000 people. The World Health Organization recommends one doctor per 10,000 people, Ndifor said. Cameroon says it currently needs at least 30,000 health workers, including doctors, in the country, which is suffering from Boko Haram terrorism that has left more than 36,000 people dead, a separatist crisis that has killed more than 6,000 people and displaced about 750,000 others, and the spillover of sectarian violence from neighboring Central African Republic. The Cameroon Medical Council says the Central African country in 2013 launched a program to train about 1,000 doctors in order to improve the doctor-patient ratio, which was then one doctor per 17,000 patients. But the government recruits less than 100 doctors each year due to financial constraints, officials say. Cameroon's Ministry of Public Health says it expected privately owned hospitals to recruit a majority of the doctors upon graduation from medical school, but hospitals owned by individuals, communities, and churches also recruit less than 100 doctors each year. Even when recruited, the doctors say they are paid about $100 per month in private hospitals and about $220 per month in government hospitals. 29-year-old Jato Godlove is an unemployed doctor. He says he yearns to be in a hospital saving lives, as he was taught to do during his 7 years of study at the Faculty of Medicine of Cameroon's University of Bamenda. Jato says hardship is making him consider following the several thousand of his peers who have left the country.
I find myself being really restrained and restricted in my capacity to help my family. I even have some peers who venture out of medicine because they see that as a medic, when you get somewhere to offer your services, they will tell you they want to pay you 50,000 francs a month, which is really funny. Some of them have families. When they find themselves in such situations, they see better opportunities abroad. I think you can't blame them.
Jato said poor working conditions, including the lack of hospital equipment and poor pay, are also pushing nurses, midwives, and laboratory technicians to join doctors in leaving Cameroon for greener pastures in Europe and North America. Monkey Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
A high-level Caribbean ambassador said today it is crucial to establish a new international special tribunal to seek reparations for transatlantic slavery and its legacies. Reuters reported earlier this month that support was building among Africa and Caribbean nations for the creation of such a tribunal. For over four centuries, at least 12.5 million Africans were kidnapped, forcibly transported thousands of kilometers by mainly European ships and merchants, and sold into slavery. David Comissong, the Barbados ambassador to the Caribbean community, said a tribunal is needed to handle reparations claims. He said the tribunal would require a positive decision by the UN General Assembly. Comissong was speaking at the third session of the Permanent Forum of People of African Descent in Geneva. The forum initially suggested the establishment of the tribunal last year. Many in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa are lamenting the end of the Piazza or Arada, a district mostly demolished due to a renewal plan. The area, set up at the turn of the 20th century, included cobbled streets with large trading houses, mostly Indian, Armenian, Greek, French, and Ethiopian. Since the 1920s, warehouses operated by traders have stood alongside small kiosks and stores, while elegant stone and wood villas owned by wealthy merchants or dignitaries coexisted with more modest homes. The Reporter newspaper, citing official data, said 56 listed buildings in Piazza have already been totally or partially demolished. But Addis Ababa Mayor Adanech Ababe has defended the project. According to the French news agency AFP, she says it will benefit all of society with the creation of wide roads, bike paths, and children's playgrounds. She says some areas were falling apart even before we started demolishing them, she said. We have preserved the memories that should have been preserved. A And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehye Suwuhi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.